Blog Talk Radio.
And we're back. Hello, happy Sunday to you, everyone. Thanks for joining me today. My name is Tricia. This is Tricia's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime with all of you true crime lovers out there, and we get down to the nitty-gritty good stuff, let me tell you. Today's show is brought to you by the Doris Day Animal Foundation. This is a national nonprofit public charity. It was founded in 1978 by Doris Day with the simple goal of finding homes for pets that are unwanted. She is an amazing woman. You can go to her website. It's Anyway, it's the Doris Day Foundation, and it is truly an amazing site. What this woman has done is something that, when you look at it, you know, she could be doing so many other things, Doris Day. She's famous. She's wealthy. She could be jetting off somewhere and doing what other, you know, the beautiful people do. Instead, she has stayed in California all these years, and she has devoted her life to finding homes for animals that are unwanted. So give it a check out, okay? It's a charity. It's a nonprofit. That's the Doris Day Foundation. Okay, time to, here it is, DorisDayAnimalFoundation.org. That makes sense. And it's time for the legal goo now. Get ready. It is all goo all the time. The opinions expressed on this program are absolutely the opinions of the hosts and the guests. Do keep in mind that Tricia's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuth.com and ForumsForJustice.org. Okay. I'm going to start off with really good news. You know, my co-host, Michael in Minnesota, he had that devastating fire. It was so awful. He lost three of his four beloved pets. They were his kids. In addition to losing literally every single thing he had, including his cars. That's how terrible this fire was. Well, I've been speaking to him over the past weeks, and obviously he has been beyond devastated. And last night, he sent me a text with a picture of the cutest dog I've ever seen, and this dog is healing Michael's heart. Her name is Nanette, and Michael got her at the Humane Society in Minnesota, and I think my my bouncer in chat is going to post a link to my Facebook page where I have a picture of the dog up there, and you will see she is just a lover. And Nanette is truly healing Michael's heart. Now, here's the interesting thing. Nanette was found in Tennessee, abandoned and starving to death. I don't know how she ended up at the Minnesota Humane Society, but apparently she was so shy around people, the people at the Humane Society thought, we'll never find her a home. Well, here Michael shows up, goes into her cage, and Nanette just goes right up to him, presses against him, and starts licking him, and he knew right then. She's just a love bug, as he puts it, and she is adorable. So we're going to start off with good news, and I love doing that because it is rare. Joining us tonight, let's go to our phones, is our wonderful, incredible friend, Kathy at CourtChatter.com. Kathy, how are you today, my dear?
I'm doing great, Tricia. How are you?
I am great. And also joining us is a guest we've had on before. We have determined that he will be a guest on a regular basis, whether he wants to or not. It's Charles Mittelstadt. He is a criminal defense investigator. And how are you today, Mr. Mittelstadt?
I'm fantastic, Tricia. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Now, a little bit later on in the show, in fact, Kathy, why don't you give us a little preview of what you're going to be talking about later in the show?
Oh, Julie Schenecker. Her trial begins tomorrow. She's a mom in Florida who shot and killed both of her teenagers and originally told police it's because they were too mouthy. Many webs involved in this story.
And who out there has kids hasn't had the mouth off to them? I mean, I could tell you a few minutes ago, mouthy right here. I didn't pull out a gun, you know. I just told them I'm not gonna feed you. You have to make your own sandwich. So, anyway, so we'll be talking about that horrific crime. It's just I remember when that happened, and those kids were so adorable. But we're gonna talk about crime tonight as well with Charles Mittelstadt. And did you know the biggest problem facing our criminal justice system as far as putting innocent people behind bars is faulty eyewitness testimony? I've been learning about this ever since I have been introduced to Mr. Mittelstadt, and I'll tell you, it is appalling. And Charles Mittelstadt has rolled out his new website. But, Charles, I'm going to let you talk about it. Tell us a little bit how you got involved in this and why it's such a big problem, and why should we even care?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to thank you so much for the opportunity, Tricia, because it is, as hopefully you'll agree in the next few minutes, you know, it's just an astounding problem that we have known exists for the last 20 years, and the best word that I can describe the issue that still remains at the forefront of injustices that happen in this country is inexplicable. And so what we've rolled out after I've been within the legal field for the past 20 years, operating as a criminal defense investigator, and so day in, day out, I have a front row seat to the criminal justice system. And this is not, and I want to make it clear up front, this is not a defense perspective or a defense-oriented justice project. I mean, this is the issue that we're going to talk about tonight is universally accepted by prosecutors, judges, forensic experts. Everybody agrees. There's literally no disagreement whatsoever by anybody that this is the leading contributing cause to wrongful convictions. And what is astounding is the fact that it still exists. And so the project is called the 13.5 Foundation. The website is 13.5.org, and it's 1-3 and then spelled out and a half.org. I think there's a link on your website, as a matter of fact.
Yes, there is.
The reason that name was chosen is because it's a very obscure reference. 13.5 is obscure to the outside world, to the inside world. It symbolizes one judge, 12 jurors, and half a chance. And I want to take that obscure reference and have it become the symbol for the reforms that are so needed in our criminal justice system. And so what this 20-plus year career has led me to is, again, the equivalent of a front row seat to these issues. And this fire started burning within me. And there are, I want to make clear, there's lots of organizations that are attempting to achieve the same thing. Most of them, they're really, you can break down the justice organizations into two categories. Most of them are either lobbying efforts, which are folks who are going behind the scenes trying to bring about change, or they are exoneration-related projects, which both obviously very noble causes, very noble approaches. My approach is more of a public awareness campaign. I want to create some public outrage. I want to shine a light on this and create public outrage so that once and for all we can give politicians the political courage, the political cover to bring about this change that is so desperately needed. And so what that brings us to is – I'm sorry,
go ahead. No, please continue. You're much more interesting than I am. Please continue.
Well, what it brings us to is this number one issue. I mean, there are obviously lots of different flaws within the system that contribute to injustice. And by the way, I come from the perspective of, you know, the system is not fatally flawed or riddled with corruption. I think overall the criminal justice system clearly has flaws, but it's fundamentally sound. But there are numerous flaws that contribute to injustice on a daily basis. And the ones that the general public are most familiar with are going to be these DNA-related exonerations, which are phenomenal, and the Innocence Project that was started by Barry Scheck over 20 years ago is, you know, single-handedly responsible for creating the atmosphere and the application of DNA technology to facilitate these exonerations. But we have to understand that they only deal with a tiny, tiny percentage of the possible cases of wrongful convictions out there. And so it's only going to deal primarily with cases that preceded 1989 and cases that involve biological evidence. And so when those conditions are met, it's a phenomenal litmus test, and it's been responsible for 316 DNA-related exonerations. I mean, that's fantastic. But the significance of that is there's only, on average, one out of 20 cases, criminal cases, that actually involve DNA technology. And so for mm-hmm. those people who are on the receiving end of injustice, there's really, you know, little hope. There's no litmus test. And the likelihood of an exoneration is greatly reduced, and it seldom happens. And so
we're talking. Oh, go ahead. Keep going.
Go ahead, please. No, trust me. I can talk for hours, so you feel free to jump in at any time.
Okay, I just wanted to let everybody know we're talking with Charles Mittelstadt. Mr. Mittelstadt is a criminal defense investigator and is rolling out a new website called 13andahalf.org. That's the number 13 and then the words andahalf.org. And its goal is to educate the public, to create outrage, if you will, at just how flawed the eyewitness testimony is. And Charles, I'm really glad that you said this is not a defense tactic, if you will, because that was my concern when I first read about this. I thought people are going to look at this and go, oh, yeah, a typical, you know, defense investigator, defense attorney trying to get the guilty guy off. And it's just the opposite. Imagine if you were pointed to as being a criminal, someone who committed a crime. You know, it's unfathomable to think until you put yourself in that position. And Charles, maybe you could tell us a couple of stories of just some horrific, faulty eyewitness identification, and then we're going to talk about how it can be fixed. It's a pretty easy fix to make it at least a stronger and more foolproof way of identifying criminals. But give us a couple of horror stories, if you will, so people understand this can happen to anybody.
Well, it absolutely can happen to anybody. And here's the thing about it, Tricia, is it's, you know, I'm glad that you pointed out that it's not a defense thing. And by the way, this is all, you know, all of this is completely apolitical. It's not defense-oriented. It's not, you know, it's not soft on crime. It's nothing like that. In fact, it's based upon a total commitment to you know, the Bill of Rights and due process. I mean, there's nothing that could be more patriotic, more American about this. And so it's something that everybody can get behind. And the reality of this particular flaw is, and it's different than some of the other flaws that exist, but the reality is that when this particular flaw causes a wrongful conviction, everybody loses. And so everybody's wasted time. But, I mean, beyond the obvious direct victims, the victim of injustice themselves, you have the, you know, already overburdened, overcrowded court system that has just wasted its time. It's mm-hmm. becoming more, it becomes more backlogged. You have law enforcement that, you know, that pursued a case, and ultimately pursued the wrong suspect. And so all of their time is wasted. And as we all know, law enforcement is already understaffed and over assigned cases, and they're always going, you know, they're always trying to solve the next case, clear the next case, because mm-hmm. the backlog is so big. But the real significance is that the true perpetrator remains at large. And so everybody, right. literally everybody has lost. Nobody wins in this. And most prisons throughout the system face overcrowding issues, and so again, the only one who could possibly benefit from this, and I say this half cynically, but not so much, is the prison industry. Now, I don't suspect. I'm not saying there's some conspiracy theory here, and that's why this still exists. But truly, as most prisons are becoming privatized, yeah, arguably, they may have some incentive to see that this doesn't get corrected. But they would be the only ones. I mean, everybody else has some benefit, you know, has some interest in seeing that they get it right the first time. And so that's what makes it so, you know, inexplicable. And, you know, there's not enough time to talk about the horror stories. Can you imagine? I mean, you already kind of set the table for this, Tricia, as far as just putting to the listeners out there this possibility that what if you were on the receiving end of this? What if you were falsely accused? What if you were fingered by somebody and you had no culpability whatsoever? Maybe you weren't even in the area. And you don't always have an alibi. This, you know, a lot of times misidentification can be caught before it results in an injustice, but not always, and a lot of times it isn't obviously caught. And so it's just really very simple-minded stuff. I mean, we have a reform that we know scientifically. This isn't, you know, this isn't something I made up. This is hundreds and hundreds of studies out there, papers written by the brightest legal scholars, by the most prestigious legal institutions, the federal government. Everybody agrees. I mean, this isn't something that anybody's going to debate me on. I challenge anybody to debate me on it, but it's not up for debate. It's a fact. And the fact of the matter is faulty eyewitness identification can be reduced by 90% given this reform.
Let me ask you, we're going to get into the reform in just a minute. Just a couple of the horror stories that pop into your mind, because here's the thing I think the public needs to understand. When you put a face to it, this faulty eyewitness testimony, when you put a face to it, that's what they can grab on and hold on to. So give us a couple of the big ones that make you just lose sleep at night.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some cases over the years that clearly dealt with this issue. And, you know, in some cases, if other evidence exists that can create an alibi, then that evidence alone is not going to win or lose the day. And fortunately, you know, the cases that I've been involved with, for the most part, there were other pieces of evidence that overshadowed the eyewitness identification issue. But I've also had some that didn't, and there's nothing more tragic. I mean, the way that I view this, and I'm frankly, I don't know how else to view this. I mean, but basically what we have here is we have a known flaw that we know statistically contributes. It's the leading contributing cause to wrongful convictions. We have a reform that we know can reduce the potential for wrongful convictions to occur. And we have about 25% implementation of this reform on a national level. And the federal government single-handedly could resolve this issue overnight. I mean, they could mandate this. And and so by not doing that, it's the equivalent of knowing of a deadly disease, having the cure, and withholding it from the public. There's no other way to look at it. And anybody who is victimized by this, frankly, becomes, you know, arguably a political prisoner. And it's absolutely foreseeable that until we have national implementation of this reform, that further injustices are going to occur. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so despicable about this. It's a national disgrace.
Well, let's talk about then the reforms. We're talking with Charles Mittelstadt about something that is pervasive in our justice system, and that is faulty eyewitness testimony. This is not about the defense side trying to get innocent or trying to get guilty people off, not at all. This is about innocent people who have been fingered in a crime. They've pointed at him and said, that's the guy, and they're arrested, and boom, their life is changed. And unless you have the money for a lawyer, you're really up a creek. I mean, there's nothing you can do. And what's so frustrating, Charles, is it is a simple fix, and the federal government knows about it. You can go to 13andahalf.org. That's the number 13 and then the words and a half .org. And there is a tab there you can click on and look at all of the studies that the federal government has done showing this problem, and it's an easy fix. So tell us how the eyewitness testimony, how they do it now, and what you're proposing be just standard procedure in all law enforcement agencies.
Sure. And by the way, I wasn't trying to side skirt your question about give us a couple of examples. Frankly, there are so many examples that it's hard to figure out where to start. But there's a statistic that will that illustrates it perfectly, and that is, of the 316 DNA exonerations, these are factually innocent folks. These aren't folks that were exonerated on some technicality. These are people that we know were factually innocent. And in 50% of those cases, the true perpetrators were identified based upon the DNA. So those 316 cases are a phenomenal model. But here's the statistic that really illustrates the point that you were trying to get to and the horror of all this, and that is that by analyzing the contributing causes to those 316 wrongful convictions, we know now scientifically that faulty eyewitness identification played the leading role in 75% of those cases.
Wow, okay? That
so,
is bad.
So if you want to know about, if you want to know, read about horror stories firsthand, Google, you know, any one of these DNA exonerations, and three out of four of those will involve this very issue.
Okay,
and
got
on
it.
Average, these people have you know, spent anywhere from, you know, 15 to 18 years in prison. Can you imagine having your life? Can you imagine being plucked out of your house tonight and being locked up and put into a, you know, a 7x10 cell for the next 18 years, knowing you didn't do anything, being ripped away from your family, your mother and father and son and daughter and everybody that you love and cherish in your entire life? I mean, I don't think Hollywood could come up with, you know, a more horrific storyline. And
I agree.
That's what's happening, okay? And so what this is about is we can prevent this. You know, the exonerations are, and all these justice projects that deal with exonerations, I mean, they are, you know, they're priceless. They're to be commended to no end. But my approach and my point to this is let's reduce the potential for these wrongful convictions to occur. That way we don't have to count on trying to go back retroactively and correct them, because we know we're not going to catch them all. And why should we do that when we can prevent anybody from being a victim? And so,
okay, well, let's talk about, tell us how we do eyewitness testimony now. How does it usually work?
Okay. So what we're talking about is photo arrays, we're talking about show-ups, and we're talking about lineups. And so a photo array is, if you're a witness, Tricia, and you were on a corner somewhere and observed something that's of interest to law enforcement, they would bring you in to the station, and after they had developed a suspect, they would sit you down, and they'd ultimately like to show you some photographs. Okay, mm-hmm. That's what's called a photo array. A lineup is when, you know, it's kind of like what you see in the movies, when it's a live showing of suspects, of a suspect mm-hmm. within a lineup with, you know, four, five, six other similar-looking individuals. Mm-hmm. That's what a show-up is. Or I'm sorry, that's what a lineup is. And then a show-up is a crime just occurred, you're a witness, they caught somebody a block down the street, they're going to put you in a police car, they're going to drive down the street, and you'll stay in the car, and you'll look at the person they have handcuffed in custody to see if that's the person you just saw run out of a building 5 minutes before.
Okay.
Okay?
And why are all those things bad? Why don't they work?
None of them are bad. I mean, that's in theory, it's how it should work, but there are certain procedures that have to happen in order to make it work properly, in order to reduce the potential for you as a well-intentioned witness to make, you know, prevent you or reduce the potential for you making a mistake. And so the way that it's been happening for the, you know, previous decades is that let's take the photo array, because that's the most prevalent one. All right, a photo array, I think most of the listeners have probably seen either in a movie or on a television show, but it's basically a sheet of paper, and it has six photographs on it, two rows, three horizontally, and another row right below it. And so as the witness, I'm the police detective. I call you in. I say, Tricia, I'm about to show you some photos, and what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to pick the person that you saw out there that night, okay? Mm-hmm. And now I slide it in front of you, and you look at it, and the person that you saw that night does not immediately jump out to you, okay?
Okay.
And so what you start engaging in is you start looking for the person that most resembles the person you saw that night.
Okay.
Now you're engaging in what's called comparative shopping. And so you're looking at all these individuals, all six of them, and ultimately, like, you know, I could be number two.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, okay, how sure are you? Well, I'm not entirely sure, but it could be. Okay, mm-hmm. Tell you what, I'm going to probably have you come in next week, and I'll have you look at this again. Great. So next week you come back in, the detective shows it to you again, and you study it, you continue to engage in this comparative shopping, and ultimately, you know, I think it looks, could be, it probably is number two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, first of all, you know, as the detective in the case, I developed the suspect, I'm invested. I'm invested emotionally in this. I'm in, you know, from a human nature standpoint, I think I'm right. I'm the cop. Mm-hmm. I've made lots of other arrests. I think I do a good job, and I think I've got this right. And so whether I intentionally or even unintentionally engage in some suggestiveness, I can influence you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is ultimately you say, well, okay, well, so you feel it's number two? Yeah, I guess it's number two. Okay, do me a favor, put your initials next to number two. That's what's considered a positive identification. That now moves on to a prosecution. The DA gets it. Now, as the defense attorney, I get this as part of discovery, and on paper it looks like, well, we've got a positive identification against my client. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I tell my client, bad news, buddy, you were positively ID'd. And so unless you have good, aggressive defense attorneys, investigators, et cetera, to kind of go back and redevelop the evolution of this ID, which almost never happens,
mm-hmm.
you are now left with the fact that he was positively identified. You are now going to come to trial. You're going to see him sitting next to his attorney when you're sitting on the stand testifying, and the prosecutor is going to say, do you see the person that you saw that night? Well, naturally, he's sitting right next to the defense attorney, and you're going to point right to him in the courtroom. Yep, he's sitting right there. Would you please stand up? And the defendant stands up. That's how this happens, okay? Now, the mm-hmm. way to avoid this is quite simple. And again, this is not Charles Mittelstadt's idea of this reform. This has been universally accepted. This is something that was developed 20 years ago. The Department mm-hmm. of Justice wrote this exact protocol 10 years ago. This is every single reputable justice project is pushing for the same thing. This has been legislated in a handful of states. So even there are states that have recognized this, and they are proactive, and they understand the benefit of not making this mistake. They understand that everybody loses. They understand it costs everybody time and money, and it creates victims. And so,
mm-hmm.
but it's too slow in coming. We only have 25% implementation at best. And so what the reform involves is this. Here's how the procedure ought to work. I'm the cop. I'm the guy that developed the suspect. I don't need to be the one administering the lineup to you, okay, because I know who the suspect is. And so
okay, so the first thing we do is make the cop that made the arrest, he's not involved in the photo array or the lineup, right?
That's correct. That's what you call blind administration. So you bring in a different cop who doesn't know who the suspect is, and he's the one that puts this in front of you. So he can't, even if he wanted to, he can't lead you in any particular direction. All right.
Okay.
Now, or before that even happened, there's what's called a cautionary instruction. And that cautionary instruction is, listen, Tricia, I'm about to show you some photographs. Now,
mm-hmm.
the person you saw out there that night may or may not be amongst the photographs I'm about to show you. Okay.
Oh, okay.
You should feel no pressure, basically, to pick anybody out. If you
mm-hmm.
see, you know, it's the bottom line to it is if you see the person that you identify, great. If you don't, you don't. So it removes any suggestiveness, and it removes any pressure that you feel like, well, the cop probably knows what he's talking about, so the suspect must be in there somewhere.
Got to be.
Okay?
I got to pick
how
somebody.
A lot of, right. You don't have to pick anybody. Okay. So that's what's called the cautionary instruction. Then you have the blind administration, which is I'm not the one administering this to you.
Mm-hmm.
Then as far as the lineup, it's not a photo array. In other words, we're not going to allow you to engage or encourage you to engage in this comparative shopping by putting six photographs on one sheet of paper. What we're going to do is we're going to do what's called a sequential showing. And so the administrator, the cop who's administrating this showing is going to put one picture down at a time, okay? Put
mm-hmm.
one photo, let you look at it, study it as long as you want, remove it, put the next one down, and so on and so forth, okay? So there's no comparative shopping.
Right.
The next thing is, you know, and assuming you pick one, you say, yep, that, you know, the second photograph you showed me, I'm
mm-hmm.
pretty certain that's him. The next thing is what's called a confidence statement. After you've identified somebody, you will then, in your own words, in your own handwriting, complete what's called a confidence statement. And that basically says on this particular date I was shown a series of photographs, and I picked one, and I'm 100% sure, I'm 75% sure, whatever, however you want to articulate your confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing is this whole process is memorialized. It's videotaped. There's not a police department in this country that doesn't have videotape equipment. They use it every day for interrogations, for interviews. And so there's literally, this is the entire reform. It doesn't involve any new equipment. It doesn't involve any capital expenditures. It just involves a different way of doing things. It involves training. And literally the training, I just did it. Okay, if you were a cop, I just retrained you. And that's it. And if law enforcement administers photo arrays that way and witness identification that way, it will reduce the potential for misidentification, faulty eyewitness identification, by up to 90%.
Okay? Okay. Charles, hold
now,
on
why
one second.
Would we not
Charles,
do that?
Charles, hold on one sec. We do have a question. I'm going to go to Kathy at Court Chatter. Kathy, you have a chat room going. You have a question from somebody in there for Charles Mittelstadt about 13.5.org. Faulty eyewitness testimony, it needs to stop, and that's what this is all about. Go ahead, Kathy.
Yes, hi, Charles. Okay, yeah,
hi,
so a member of my chat room who is called Red has a question, and I'm just going to read it. Juries tend to find eyewitness testimony very compelling despite critical contrary conditions surrounding the actions associated with the crime. What are your thoughts concerning the use of expert psychological witnesses to dissect eyewitness testimony from the stand?
Well, that's a great point, and he's absolutely right. Juries do find it compelling, and that's why it's so important to get it right. And my thoughts are we don't need to involve additional experts on this. What we just need to do is do it correctly. A lot of cases don't come down to just one eyewitness. Some do. I mean, listen, sometimes that's almost the entirety of the case. But in other circumstances, there's other circumstantial evidence that may contribute to the prosecution, to painting the picture, to telling the story. But I would not be in favor of that because, as we all know, and we've seen it over and over and again in high-profile cases where you get a front-row seat to the gavel-to-gavel coverage of a case, and you see how the prosecution brings in their expert, and they have one opinion, and then the defense brings in their expert, and they have a contrary opinion, and it becomes a battle of experts.
Right.
Why not just do this right to begin with? We have the ability to do it, so let's just do it right and avoid all this.
Charles, why won't police departments do this? You say some police departments have implemented. The federal government doesn't want to step in because I'm sure it's going to be about a state rights issue or something ridiculous like that. But why? What could possibly they say against changing it?
It's inexplicable. Inexplicable. I can't imagine. I still don't have the answer to that. It's the most astounding thing in the world. Again, everybody has incentive to. And by the way, it's really not a state's right thing. Here's what happens with the federal government. The federal government dole out money. It's mostly counterterrorism money that they've been doling out by the handful since 9/11 to local state law enforcement agencies for ballistic gear, for tactical units, for better sniper rifles, for you name it. They're doling out tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to each department. And they have certain strings attached to that money. They have mandates that these departments have to comply with in order to be eligible to receive this money. This can just be one more of those strings. That's all it has to be is, listen, you want the money, you have to practice this reform. It's that simple. The federal government can bring this to an end tomorrow if they wanted to. But they haven't, and they won't, and no one will be able to tell you why.
It's
the craziest thing. It's just that crazy. And, by the way, in Georgia here, well, we do have a provision, and Georgia is what's called a post state. That's Peace Officers Standards and Training Council. And it's a standard within law enforcement, post is fabulous, by the way. They do an excellent job at not only training, but at policing their accredited law enforcement officers is from a disciplinary standpoint. They investigate, they withdraw certification, they do a good job. And they teach this at post at the academy. I have a case right now in Georgia in which there was a eyewitness identification that was done, and they actually videotaped the whole thing using the old process. I mean, thankfully, we have this whole thing memorialized. We saw, you know, you can see with your own eyes how they led and how the cop literally pressured this witness into picking somebody out. It's it is mind-boggling. But they use the old procedure, and it results, I mean, it clearly, in this case, the one that I have, resulted in a bad identification. And fortunately, we have additional evidence to establish an alibi in the form of some cell tower records that will assist us in placing our defendant. But even in states that have legislated this change, there's still resistance by some folks in law enforcement that have been doing things a certain way, and there's obviously a lack of oversight on an executive level within that department for this to even happen. So there are no guarantees, but I don't have the answer as to why this hasn't happened. It doesn't make any sense.
Do you know anybody I could talk to? Because we've tried to find somebody that will explain why they don't want to do this, and nobody wants to talk, obviously.
You won't find any reasonable-minded person who would attempt to articulate something that is so that has no explanation. Mm-hmm. I mean, is anybody going to explain away the fact that they have the ability to prevent injustice 90% of the time, but for what could the possible explanation be for not doing so?
Right, there
we
is
know
none.
That if you there is none, you're not going to get there that. You're not going to find that gift.
Charles, what about? This is just me being nosy and butting in, so I do apologize. But to me, I think what the public needs to see, like I said, is they need to put a face on this. And, you know, maybe get somebody out there that can go around and give media interviews who had this happen to them and the horror that they went through and all of that. Somebody that would be willing to speak to it so people can say, look at this. This can't happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But here's the problem. And this is, you know, I studied this whole issue for 5 years, Tricia, before I launched this. This nonprofit has been in the works for years, literally. And here's the conclusion that I've come to. You can take any one of these 316 exonerees, okay, who on average spent, say, 15 years in prison, okay? They were a political prisoner for 15 years. They finally get exonerated, and they walk out of prison after 15 years, and there is maybe a handful of people waiting to see them make their exit. It barely gets mentioned on the 6 o'clock news, okay? You could have, a journalist or a student who, accidentally steps over into Iran and gets picked up and is taken hostage for a year, and the world media will focus every single night on that story.
On that, right.
If you have somebody who's been plucked from their life and away from their loved ones for 15 years, and when they are freed, nobody cares. And the conclusion that I've come to is that when it comes to defendants, the public generally doesn't care. It's one of these things where if it doesn't affect you, if you aren't touched by it, if you haven't experienced it personally, then it's probably, you know what, I'm never going to have to deal with that. So, you know, I'm glad that guy got out, but it really doesn't. It's not a big deal in my life. And so the approach, the focus that we're taking, here's how I think people do care. Okay, mm-hmm. I find that people generally think, well, the defendants, if they didn't do that, they probably did something else.
Did something
and
else,
so there's not,
right.
There's not a lot of empathy for them. Mm-hmm. But those are the direct, you know, direct victims of injustice. What I believe the public has great empathy for, and this has been my experience when I've spoken in private and publicly about this, is they have empathy for the indirect victims. Okay, you can't
the family members.
Even if you've got people feel for those people. They feel for mothers and fathers and sons and daughters mm-hmm. who are denied, you know, access and physical and emotional and financial comfort of a loved one. A child is innocent, didn't do anything for his father or mother to go to prison. So you have to feel for that person, and you have to feel for how they've been affected by this. And so our approach with 13.5 is to profile the indirect victims, because for every direct victim, there are literally dozens and dozens of indirect victims. So this injustice that we're talking about doesn't just affect, you know, I mean, if you just take the DNA exonerees, 316, you're probably talking, you know, 10,000 people that were affected by these wrongful convictions. But
right.
keep in mind that those are just DNA related. Again, mm-hmm. they don't even scratch the surface. Most cases don't involve DNA. There are potentially tens, hundreds of thousands of people sitting in prison today who are victims of wrongful convictions with regard to eyewitness misidentification. And
right.
these are the people, this is what we need to prevent. And if you take 10,000 or 100,000 and you multiply that by all of the indirect victims, this is an epidemic problem.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%. Well, what I would love is to talk to some of the indirect victims and even the victims, because I know mainstream media doesn't care, but I do. And my little section of the world is quite small, I'll admit. But I know your frustration in dealing with the mainstream media. You can have all of the evidence right there in front of you. It's the best story in the world. And if they don't feel it, they won't pick it up. You know, it's all about
yeah.
sensationalism and just trying to get the highest ratings, and that's what's so frustrating. But I would love to talk to these people, Charles. Do you have anybody you can set us up with?
Yeah, well, that's a lot of what our messaging, a lot of what our effort in this public awareness is going to be focused on is in telling those stories. We're going to be doing a lot of mini documentaries on these on the indirect victims and, of course, the direct victims as well. But mm-hmm. that's how we plan on, you know, building the empathy, on building this grassroots support. I mean, ultimately, the end game for our effort has to do with building public support, public outrage,
yes.
and shining a light on this to the point where nobody can walk away from this.
Right.
And it's, you know, we've seen this, you know, what we're trying to do, frankly, was not even possible 5 years ago. Social media has created opportunities to do this really in a very short period of time. I mean, if you look at the Casey Anthony verdict that outraged a lot of folks, I mean, mm-hmm. just through one effort in a matter of a couple of weeks, they were able to create enough public outrage to get a law passed, which essentially makes it illegal to not report the disappearance of a child. And
right.
that all happened as a result of one person who started a grassroots effort and created some public outrage, and literally in a matter of a couple of weeks, what they did is they created political cover for politicians to get off their butts and do the right thing, and lit a fire under someone's ass, and it happened. And
right.
that's what we're talking about doing here, is building this support, building this outrage, again, productive outrage. We're not talking about doing anything, you know, any kind of dissidence or any. We're talking about educating the public, building empathy, building a following, and then ultimately applying the appropriate pressure to bring about this change and see the national implementation. Until that happens, the secondary effort is to educate the public that sits on the juries, and,
mm-hmm.
and to create more skeptical jurors who understand this issue and will hold law enforcement accountable for doing this the right way. And if you sit on if you're sitting in a jury and you're listening to eyewitness evidence being presented to you, and it's being done outside of this reform, then you ought to discount it. And the prosecution should not. If obviously, if there's other evidence and it's compelling, but you almost should discount the eyewitness evidence if it was obtained using an old, outdated, flawed process and procedure.
Right. Go ahead, please, continue.
And then the second thing is, obviously, we want to educate defense attorneys on applying that pressure as well. Sadly, even a lot of defense attorneys aren't aware of the reform, and they don't know, you know, they don't have the tools to hold, you know, the law enforcement involved in the case accountable, to hold the prosecution mm-hmm. involved. And so that's another part of our effort, is to make sure that everybody is aware of the research, of the reforms, and to make sure that any time this evidence comes up and was obtained using a flawed approach, that somebody pay for it.
Well, I will do it. I mean, I certainly don't have any sort of power, but what little I can do, Charles, I will certainly help you in any way I can. And I know there's wonderful people on websleuths.com and forumsforjustice.org and Twitter and Facebook that, once they hear about it, hopefully will get behind your effort. And what can people do? I guess the best thing to do is to go to your website and start from there, right?
Yeah, if you go to the website, there's more information. And in fact, all the research is there. Again, this is not Mittelstadt's idea. This is there's a lot smarter people that determined this long, long, long before I got involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to bring a different approach to it. And so all of the research is there, all of the information with regard to your representatives, local, state, national representatives is on the site. You have every ability to communicate with them. But first and foremost, just supporting the effort, following it, not asking for any money. In fact, I haven't asked for a penny. This is not about raising money. This is about gaining support and educating the public and creating public outrage. So following on Twitter, following on Facebook, building this following so that ultimately we have the numbers to start taking spot surveys, to start doing petitions, to start applying very specific campaigns in certain areas where there is no movement on reform. So
exactly.
But that all comes from having the numbers. And so our first effort is to build the support.
Give us your website again right before we are done, so people will know where to go.
It's 13.5 spelled out .org, 13.5.org. Twitter
org,
is
yes.
Yes, Twitter is No to Injustice. No to Injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And those two will get you everything you need.
And I'm telling you, people, you've got to go to this website. It is fascinating. Again, it's not a defense attorney thing. It's not about getting criminals off. It's about making sure innocent people are not put behind bars. Charles Mittelstadt, I can't thank you enough. I hope to be working a lot with you, and I'll help in any way I possibly can, okay?
Absolutely. Listen, I appreciate the time, Tricia. This is invaluable. And also, I do want to mention, you were kind enough
sure.
to put a link to a little mini documentary that we just released on this very issue on eyewitness misidentification. It's a 4.5-minute video. I'd encourage your listeners to watch it. It covers a lot of what we talked about in a much more succinct way. And please like it, pass on, retweet it. Let's get that thing out there, and let's educate as many people as we can.
Absolutely. Charles Mittelstadt, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll be talking again very soon, I'm sure. Take care now.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks, Kathy.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Tricia. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow. You know, it's so frustrating because you sit there and you know that eyewitness identification is a problem. It can be easily fixed. And I can't get anybody to talk to me as to why they want to keep it as it is. And, Kathy, like you were stating in chat, you know, it's maybe it's the attitude that the police think they have the bad guy. That's all they care about. They think he's guilty, and that's what matters. End of story. I would hope to God Almighty in heaven that if that is the case, it is a handful of police that think that way. What are your thoughts, Kathy?
Well, what other reason could there be? What
there isn't. I can't imagine.
I want to hear a logical, legal reason why police would not want the photo lineups to be done that way, to be conducted by someone who did not make the arrest, to have an unbiased person come in with the victim, to show them photos one at a time, not necessarily the whole lineup, to make it clear that in these photos may or may not be a suspect. And, you know, don't they want it to be a good eyewitness identification?
Exactly. That's what you would think. But you're right. There is no justification for it, and that's why nobody will talk about it. That's what's so frustrating. 13andahalf.org, the number 13, and then the words andahalf.org. Kathy from courtchatter.com, let's switch gears now to a case that is not in need of any eyewitness, because we have a monster mom, she's not even really a mother, who shot and killed her two adorable kids. They were just cute as can be, because they were mouthy. Let's get into that. What is her name? What's going on? Where does this craziness come from?
Okay, Julie Scheneker. If you go on courtchatter.com, I've devoted an entire tab to everything I can find and have and written on her and this trial. I've been doing a lot of work and research on this because, you know, it's not what it seems on the outset. At least I don't think it is. This is one of those cases that I will really go in with an open mind and see what it is.
Wait a minute. Didn't she admit to killing her kids?
Yes. This is not about whodunit. This is about This is about whether she is legally insane. That's what this is about.
Okay. Got it. Understood.
So,
okay.
The defense has pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. If you look, I've got it in that tab too. There's the what they call the perp walk, where they're walking her out to the police car, and they call her shaky mom. She is shaking. She can't control her mouth at all. I don't even really know how to describe what she looks like.
I'm going to go there right now and take a look. I haven't seen that yet.
No, really. So it's in that Julie Scheneker tab, and I think I just labeled it perp walk. But this is how she explains it. So there's so much to tell you. So let me just give you the overall.
We got plenty of time, so go ahead.
Okay. Her husband, she was actually in the military. She was a Russian linguist at one time. Mm-hmm. Very smart, smart woman. Her husband was in the military as well, and he was over in Afghanistan. I think he was in Qatar during this time. So she is alone with her 13-year-old son, Beau, and her 16-year-old daughter, Calix. And she has problems. But this is what the police know at the outset. At the outset, she drives her son Beau home from soccer practice and shoots him in the head and kills him in the car.
Okay.
Pulls in the driveway. She may have done it in the garage. I don't know. Leaves him in the SUV in the garage and goes in the house. And she goes up to 16-year-old Calix's room where she is sitting at the computer doing her homework and shoots her in the back of the head and kills her. And then she moves Calix's body to her bed and covers her up with a blanket. And then the next morning, the police find Julie Scheneker on her porch, either asleep, passed out, unconscious, whatever you want to call it. She's in a bathrobe, and her hands are bloody. So that's how this all starts. They find notes that she has written in the house that talked about how she was going to... She said something in her police interrogation that she was going to kill herself, but she fell asleep. After she killed her children.
Mm-hmm.
So then you see this perp walk of her, and she's got this really, really bad shape. So she says in emails to her family members that she has what's called tardive dyskinesia, and I may have murdered that, but it's also have the definition in there. And it's a shaking syndrome that comes from long-term use of antipsychotic drugs.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Oh, dear. Okay.
But the defense says that she has bipolar disorder with, I can't remember how they worded it, with psychotic attributes, I think they said, long-term depression, and substance abuse.
Oh, dear.
There's emails in there too. So they have released some of these emails. And so if you take some time to read through these emails and you can see how everyone around her knew, they could see what was going to happen. And maybe you don't think she's actually going to shoot and kill her kids, but she was not fit to be alone with those children.
Oh,
so
God, that's heartbreaking.
This happens in January of 2011. In mm-hmm. November, she gets in a car wreck, and she runs into the back of this trailer, and the cops said that she was completely out of it and they could smell alcohol, but she's released from the hospital before any blood tests were ever taken. So she didn't really get in trouble for that. But because of that accident, her kids are saying they do not want to ride in the car with her, and they're emailing their father over in Afghanistan saying, "I will not let Mom drive me anywhere. She's crazy. I won't let her drive me anywhere." And in the meantime, there's emails going between Julie and her husband where Julie's saying, you know, Calix doesn't respect me. She talks back to me all the time. She has no respect for me. I can't control her. And her husband is writing back saying, look, she's just upset at you because of the way you've been acting and because she's scared. She's scared to be in a car with you. And there's mm-hmm. these things going back and forth. Then 2 days after the car accident, they're driving in the car, her and the 16-year-old girl. And according to the 16-year-old girl, Calix, her mother doesn't like something she said, and she slaps her, and she slaps her hard, and she slaps her a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And they get home, and it continues, and she hits her again. So Calix calls the police. So this is now, get this, this is 2 months before the murders, and Child Protective Services is called in, and they kind of investigate and just figure this is a mouthy teenager not getting along with her mom, and they just drop it.
Right.
So the emails continue where she is... Her brother is now really concerned, and her brother is writing her emails saying, you've got, you know, what is going on with you? And when she writes emails, it's not understandable. She can't spell mm-hmm. anything. It's not coherent. And the really, really sad one is she has written this last email, and it appears to be after she's killed the kids that same night.
Oh, my gosh.
And she writes it to her mom, dad, sister, and brother. All one email, and you can read that on there, and I have a separate article containing just that email. And she just talks about how, thank you for everything that you've done for me, and this will all be over soon, and things that don't make any sense. She calls herself sick mentally and all these things, and it's 9 p.m. that was written. Well, if she had killed Bo on the way home from soccer practice, you figure that's before 9 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so... Her trial starts tomorrow. The defense is saying she's not guilty by reason of insanity. The interesting part of this is the prosecutors were seeking the death penalty. And just last week, they took that off the table. They're only going after life now. And they say because of her mental situation.
Well,
they think any death penalty verdict would get overturned. So they're not even going to go after that.
Now that you have explained that to me, I totally see, and my opinion has completely changed. I knew a little bit about this case, but I just watched while you were talking the video. By the way, we're talking with Kathy at CourtChatter.com about the woman who killed her two kids because they were mouthy, but she obviously is very sincerely mentally ill. And I just went to CourtChatter.com and looked at the video, the perp walk, and there is no doubt when you look at that she just isn't just in dire need of mental health. Julie Shenaker. And you should go to courtchatter.com. There's a tab that says Julie Shenaker on it. And now they've removed the death penalty. I'm glad they've done that. I don't understand why the prosecution, with all this evidence, why they don't cut her a deal, locked up in an institution for the rest of her life.
Let me tell you. So this is why I love what I do, because I my mind changes all the time on cases.
Yes.
And everybody wants to do an abrupt overview, guilty on somebody. And then you get into it, and sometimes it's not all that case. So then I think, this could have been prevented. So at first now, I'm mad at her husband. I know he's in another country, but he knows, if you read those emails, he knows what's wrong with her. And he knows she shouldn't be with those kids. I'm mad at her parents and her brother and sister, and maybe nobody could really do anything, but maybe they could. So I want to know about that. I don't know if we'll ever know really about that part of it. In the meantime, by the way, she's arrested in January, and by May, her husband has divorced her. So they're divorced. Anyway, here's what I think. So I thought the same thing. Prosecutors know that she's not mentally fit to go after the death penalty. So there is a special definition to being not guilty by reason of insanity, and you have to not know what you did and not understand right from wrong. And
right.
so knowing those two definitions, she may not meet the definition of legal insanity, and here is a good reason why. So here's another thing that was going to come out. She went to buy the gun to do this, and she, because of Florida law, she had to wait 3 days. She waited 3 days and then went back and got the gun. And she wrote in a note that was left on the counter, and the exact note has not been released, but there's been some reports about it, that
uh-huh.
said about having to wait 3 days because of the gun law before she could, before the massacre could occur.
So I think
the prosecutors may be using that a lot as premeditation. She knew she had time to, I don't know. How mentally ill is she? I don't know, because she was functioning. People don't know that other people besides family members don't know that she's this mentally ill.
Right, right. But boy, I'll tell you what, you look at that perp walk, you know what she reminds me of? Like a meth addict. And I know she's not a meth
yes.
addict, but that's what she looks like,
yes.
a crazy meth addict. And you're right. I just, I wish I could sit down with prosecutors. First of all, I wish I could be king of the world so I could just make everything my way, because it'd just be so much better. Trust me. But I wish
I say it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. You and Kathy, you and I, we could have this world cleaned up in a minute. I wish I could sit down with a prosecutor and just say, what the hell? These people are mentally ill. Why do you want to put them in prison? Our prisons are already mental health facilities. I mean, you have guards being basically mental health caretakers. But somebody like this who... I just don't understand. I mean, okay, let's say she knew what she was doing was wrong, but she didn't care. Isn't that a sign of mental illness, too? And I understand that they have this strict guideline they have to go by.
Right.
But maybe she didn't
right.
think it was wrong. Maybe she thought, yeah, I'm going to massacre him because it's the right thing to do. She didn't try and hide. Now, that's the other thing. She didn't try and hide
yeah.
what she did. That's one
right.
of the other, things where to... allow an insanity defense. Did they try and hide their deed? No, she didn't. She was sitting there on
the
porch.
Well, if you listen, I also have on there part of her interrogation. So they've released some of the audio tapes, not the video, but the audio, and you can listen to her. And I can't remember how many minutes long it is of her police interrogation. So take time to do that at some point. And she
okay.
is not there. She is not all there at all. And at one point, she asked if they're bringing her children in.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And at another time, she says something like, are they still lying there? And so they ask her all these questions. And sometimes you think, oh, she's kind of lucid. And then other times you're like, no, she's not at all. And also, I think I have a couple of YouTube links to some hearings that she's had, and where she just kind of sits there like she is just so out of it. Now, that shaking disorder that you see on that perp walk, she
mm-hmm.
says it's that one disease, and it's caused by long-term use of antipsychotic drugs. So
maybe she's been mentally ill for a long time, and we just don't know
right.
it.
And then also the she went into rehab. This is another thing. Right after the car crash that she didn't really have to be legally responsible for, but she was.
Mm-hmm.
They said she had OxyContin. She had a bunch of OxyContin in her system.
Oh dear.
Her husband made her check into rehab, and she did. But from what I can see, everything I read, it looks like she was there maybe a week. And when she came home, she then stayed in bed, and she would stay in bed. And I think he had his mom come over to the house. And she
mm-hmm.
stayed in bed, and at the first of the interrogation tapes at the police, she's telling the police, I've been in bed for 8 weeks. And when you go back and read some of the emails and stuff where he's trying to tell her parents, look, she won't get out of bed, and I'm over here in Afghanistan. I can't do anything about it. So for all these weeks leading up to these murders, she's in a really bad state, and she won't even get out of bed. And then something happens, and then she wants to go get a gun. But it does kind of bother me that she waited 3 days. This was kind of thought out.
It was thought out, absolutely. But again, it could be she thought out, I want to kill them because I'm God, and so I'll just wait for 3 days, or whatever. Now, what state
right,
was this again? Let me guess. Was this Texas
Florida.
Or Florida? I knew it. What is it, Kathy? All the craziness happens in Texas or Florida, sometimes California,
okay, well,
yeah, sometimes Georgia.
That's true. This is what I try and tell people. Everyone does believe it happens in Florida, and maybe there is a lot more crime and crazy in Florida, but because of their sunshine law they have, which means every single thing is open to the media down there, everything,
right.
every document, every court proceeding, everything, we see all the Florida cases more than any other case.
Well, that's true.
Watching
that's
it.
True.
And so I think it appears that way, but and which, by the way, so we are going to see this trial. This trial will be streamed, and I will have it on courtshatter.tv. Jury selection starts tomorrow, so we're not exactly sure when the trial will start streaming. Could be Tuesday. I don't know how long it's going to take to pick a jury. But we'll get to watch it every day, and then I'll be writing a recap about it each day. And you know how I am. My mind could change throughout this trial.
It could change 100 times, and that's what's so great is because that's what the court system is all about, is presenting
right.
which side,
right.
and then you just – I don't know if I've told you this, Kathy. I've told listeners before, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating this. You can smack me next time you see me. But I had a friend who lived in Texas and Florida, and she was convinced the reason why there were so many crazy crimes was the weather. That it was so hot and so muggy that it just made people angry and mad and nasty. And I thought, that's as good a reason as any, you know, because I'm telling you, I know there is a sunshine law, but I swear, if there is something, you know, a homeless man eats off another man's face, I don't even need to look to see where that happened. You know,
we do have some crazy happening at home here with us in Utah, you know,
well,
Tricia. I'm going to two different hearings tomorrow. Megan Huntsman, the 7 dead babies in her garage.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
She's back in court tomorrow morning, so I'm going to be there for that. And then guess what else? Tomorrow afternoon is good old Dr. Martin McNeil.
And
we're going to see if he's crazy or not.
Well, that's true. Utah, I'll tell you what, when we have bizarre crimes, they are bizarre with capital letters and exclamation points. That's the thing. You know, our crimes are just like bizarre. You know, they're just as odd as can be. And that's true. Utah is never, it's never a dull moment here. Okay,
nope,
Kathy, tell us about the Oscar Pistorius case. It's on hiatus. What's the scoop?
Yes, we're on hiatus for 2 weeks. Quite frankly, the trial was going longer than anyone planned, and the prosecutors said they had a couple of cases they had to take care of. So the judge gave everybody 2 weeks off, so this will be starting the second week. So a week from tomorrow, Pistorius will be back in court. We're going to continue with the defense case. They've only had 3 or 4 witnesses, and they said they had about 14 or 15 witnesses. So I'll be back to reporting on that again next week.
Now, just in case anybody has been living with the Taliban, Oscar Pistorius is the Blade Runner, the hero of the 2012 London Olympics. He has metal blades beneath his knees. That's how he runs, and he is on trial for killing his girlfriend, who he thought was an intruder. And boy, is it just a wacky trial. I hope the judge is not being taken in by his crying and his "my constant, my lady." It just makes me crazy. She seems like she is just like down to earth and won't put up with that nonsense. Am I right?
Well, I don't know. I've been reporting on this, I say that sometimes I think she feels sorry for him. I don't think that's going to necessarily sway her, but she does. If the prosecutor gets too hard on him, or, you know, the prosecutor one time said, why are you getting up, when Oscar was on the stand, why are you getting upset, emotional now? You haven't been emotional. And she stops the prosecutor and says, now that is not fair. He has been emotional this whole time. You know, so little things like that make you think, oh, I don't know. But then again, I think also she just knows how high profile this case is, and she just wants a nice, clean trial. So,
that was fair. That was fair to say, you know, for her to step in and say, hey, that's not right. And that's what you want a judge to be fair, no matter whose side is getting the fairness from the judge. That's what you want. So, well, Kathy, as always, you have been a joy, and thank you for waiting with the other interview. I do appreciate it. You're always welcome on here. You can come back anytime you want. You can just be on my show every single time. It would be fantastic as far as I'm concerned, and probably everybody else, too. So, just keep in touch. Just let us know what's going on. You can go to courtchatter.com. You can also go to courtchatter.tv to see the streaming trials. And courtchatter, that's the Twitter name for Kathy. I mean, she is just on top of it. So, Kathy, thank you very, very much. And give my best to everybody at Court Chatter in your chat room, okay?
I will. Thank you so much, Tricia.
Take care now. Bye-bye. Okay, well, that does it. We did it again. It's another edition of Trisha's True Crime Radio. Now, here's the scoop, my friends. Not sure if we're going to have a show next week. I am going to be traveling, kind of not sure where I'm going to end up. It's just, you know, it's kind of like Woody Guthrie. I'm going to jump on a train and just go see where I end up. Well, it's not quite like that. But anyway, I will be out and about. If we're not in on Sunday, next Sunday, it'll definitely be the Sunday after that. However, don't forget the iHeartRadio show. That's the show that we want the biggies to listen to, the people that can give us a syndication deal. So they like the show, and your comments have helped greatly. Thank you very much. So we're just keeping our fingers crossed. That's on Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern. You can go to iHeartRadio and type in Extreme Talk. Extreme Talk. That's where I'm located. And 8 o'clock Thursday nights, I will come on the Extreme Talk portion of iHeartRadio.com. You also go to Wikipedia and type in iHeartRadio Extreme Talk, and it pops up there. All kinds of ways to get it, but be sure and join me this Thursday. Not sure who the guest is going to be, but I promise it will be interesting. And please do not forget that Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by the Doris Day Foundation. This is a nonprofit foundation founded by Doris Day. She looked around Los Angeles one time and said, there are just too many dogs and cats out here that need a home. She started this foundation in 1978. It's all done through donations. And if you love dogs and cats, and who doesn't, check out the Doris Day Foundation. That's DorisDayAnimalFoundation.org. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. And do remember that Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity, WebSleuths.com LLC and ForumsForJustice.org. Do remember, Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.